Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
Do you enjoy animated films that give you the feels, or at the very least are high quality and keep your children occupied? If that's the case, then you're probably like me and you enjoy Pixar films. And that's what I want to talk about today on Free for All Friday on the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker Trent Horn. And on Free for All Friday, we talk about whatever random topics are out there that interest me, and I'm sure they will interest you as well. But before we get to the topic of today's show, I want to let you know that we have a new premium, a new bonus for our subscribers at TrentHornPodcast.com. First, a big thanks to everyone at TrentHornPodcast.com. Your support of what we're doing here allows me to do podcast episodes, to do our live stream debates with people like Sam Rocha on socialism, Cosmic Skeptic on atheism, to do our rebuttal videos. I just published a multi-hour rebuttal video to Service Christi. He published a video a while back called The Catholic Church Masterpiece of Deception. So if you want to go and check that out, be sure to go to our YouTube channel, search Council of Trent, become a subscriber there. But your support at TrentHornPodcast.com is what allows us to do all of this great work. So consider signing up to support us there. And if you subscribe for a gold level membership, you get all the rewards that we offer, like commenting on our forum channels, being able to message me, being able to get sneak peeks of our upcoming books and audio products. But at gold level, you get to have first round ability to submit questions for our open mailbag episodes. And what's new, you get a mug. You get a mug with the Council of Trent logo. And I'm really happy with our marketing department with the logo that they came up with. We went through several rounds to get it right. And when they showed me it, I knew it was the right one to have. One time, actually, I was on the bus and I was working. And I keep, if you watch Catholic Answers Live, you'll know that on my laptop, I have a Council of Trent sticker that has the logo on my laptop. And I was on a bus once, and a guy said, "Hey, I like the sticker on your laptop." I said, "Oh, yeah, it's the logo for my podcast." And the guy said, "Oh, cool. Is it a comedy podcast?" I said, "No, this is just a picture of my face. Why do you think it would be funny? This is just me." But I love it. And so you can get a mug with my mug on it, with that logo from the podcast, if you're a gold-level subscriber. So go consider joining. If you already are a gold-level subscriber or an nth metal subscriber, the most powerful metal in the multiverse, you will get a mug. Just be sure to go to TrentHornPodcast.com and update your shipping address to make sure that we send the mug to you to the right address that you're at right now, especially if you signed up several months ago or years ago if you were in on the ground floor of the podcast. So all that and more, go to TrentHornPodcast.com. Now on to the subject of today's episode, Pixar. So Pixar was a studio developed by Jeffrey Katzenberger out of a split from Disney, and now they've come back to Disney. And what I love about Pixar films is that they don't treat kids like they're annoying little children. What do I mean by that? Whenever I travel with my family, you know, we'll stay at a hotel and we don't have our TV from home. So if I'm trying to unpack my bags, I'll turn on the TV and I'll put it on something innocuous, right? Something that I know isn't offensive. So, I mean, it's offensive, but it won't have like sex or violence or something on there. So I'll pick something like Disney Channel Junior, for example, something that I know like they're not going to have something bad on there. But I mean, it's not morally offensive, but it's just offensive to me because it's really high energy, zany, annoying animation that I absolutely can't stand. And I don't like it when my kids watch it, but at the end of the day, sometimes you got to unpack your bags or run up and down from the car or take care of things. And, you know, if you're a parent, you know how it is. You got to do what you got to do. Or if you're just at your wit's end, turning on a little bit of TV is okay. And I don't care what Roald Dahl said, by the way. I talked about poetry on the podcast, I think like a year ago. And Roald Dahl did a whole poem about how TV is bad for kids. You shouldn't show kids television. My wife will read Roald Dahl books to my kids. And Roald Dahl books have words like idiot in it. You idiot. And then my kids are going around. I heard them the other day saying, "Hey, you idiot." I'm like, "Hey, where'd you learn that? I read it in a book." I'm like, "Well, not everything in books is good for you, okay?" So, you know, so we do the best you can. And so I'll put on sometimes those Disney Channel shows, and I don't like them. But Pixar films I actually like because they're art, and they share a message with kids, and they don't try to dumb it down too much for a kid's level. It's something that even adults can appreciate. And it's not like those quote-unquote kids films that cater to adults with inappropriate humor that's supposed to go over kids' heads. That's something else I can't stand when movie studios do that. I'm looking at you, DreamWorks. The only reason I'm not completely cut off from you is because you did Prince of Egypt. But otherwise, you would be in my dunzo list. I'd be dunzo with you, DreamWorks, and other animated movies where they try to appeal to parents with off-color jokes and adult humor that's supposed to go over kids' heads. I don't like when they do that. But Pixar films have timeless stories and rich characters in them, at least the earlier ones. And so they're more appealing. And so I've watched them over and over, and they have wonderful rewatch value because of that. But the more and more you watch them, the more you start having a lot of questions. The first one I want to talk about is the movie Cars, the 2006 film Cars. As you can imagine, it's a movie about cars, anthropomorphic cars, and Owen Wilson plays this race car, Lightning McQueen, that tries to go out to Hollywood to make it big, or to California, to win the Piston Cup so he can be the car of the year. And everyone wants to see him win this big race. However, he gets marooned on his way to the Piston Cup. He gets marooned in a small town, Radiator Springs Racers, where he learns the valuable lessons of slowing down a little bit and finding the better things in life than just fame and racing and having a huge ego and letting things go to your head. So first, when it comes to cars, my first question is this. They go and there's a big stadium and everybody watches the cars drive around. Now, I know track and field is a sport at the Olympics, but how many times have we filled a stadium to capacity to watch people run around a stadium on foot? It's pretty rare. So, I mean, in the Cars universe, like us watching people run around a track, that would be as popular as in the Cars universe being a bunch of cars watching cars drive around. So that's just one thought that came to me. Another thought that came to me is this, is that Cars is basically a ripoff of the old 1990s film Doc Hollywood. I think that came out in 1991. So Michael J. Fox plays a young hotshot surgeon who's on his way to get a job in Beverly Hills, but he gets sidetracked in the small town of Grady because he gets in a car accident and destroys a fence. And he gets sentenced to community service. So he's stuck in the town. He needs to fix the fence. But he realizes the quaint charm of small town life. I think there's a scene where he helps a woman with her glasses. Well, the woman says she can't see very well. And then Michael J. Fox sees the only problem with her. It's not her vision. It's that her glasses are all smudged up. And so he helps her. And then he falls in love with a woman in the town. And he leaves. And then he later comes back to realize the error of his ways. And that's basically Cars. In Cars, Owen Wilson plays Lightning McQueen. He's on his way to the Piston Cup and California, gets stuck in Radiator Springs Racers because he destroys part of the town in a car accident, a him accident, I don't know. And then he's sentenced to community service, stops and smells the roses, falls in love with a car there, leaves, but ends up coming back. So it's basically the same plot. So that's something you should definitely go and check out Doc Hollywood and compare it to Cars the next time you can. Also, I thoroughly enjoy Owen Wilson as Lightning McQueen. I just love Owen Wilson in anything because he has that wonderful wow he always says in film. So watch an Owen Wilson film and mark down all the times that he says wow. And his wow is very distinct. It almost sounds like a cat's meow. Like he'll listen to someone, he'll say, wow. Oh, that's so amazing to hear, yeah. Wow. So it's almost like a cross between a wow and a meow. There is a YouTube video called Owen Wilson Says Wow. It's a compilation of it. It's got nearly 9 million views. And I'll play it for you so you get an idea of how many times he ends up saying wow in his movies.
Flippers and all, wow.
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 Wow, no wonder she wanted to leave.
Wow.
Wow.
Yes. Wow, and how'd that affect you with guys?
Hey! Wow.
Okay, so now you get the deal there. Here's the other question I have about Cars. It's a bit of a darker one. Why do the cars have teeth and tongues? And why are there parts of the Cars universe that seem like they were built for human beings? Like, especially in the sequels, like Cars 2 and Cars 3, you'll see the cars like go into restrooms that have like toilets. Why would a car need a toilet? And the toilets seem to be about the size for human beings. Also in Cars 3, which by the way, if you rank them, Cars, the original Cars is an underrated classic. Cars 3 is fine. Cars 2 is an absolute dumpster fire. That's where they abandon the whole race car premise and it stars the side character Mater, who becomes a secret agent. It's absolutely terrible. My three-year-old tried watching Cars 2, and he said, I don't yike this, and he turned it off. Like, if your film cannot capture the attention of a three-year-old, your animated film, then you know there's something pretty wrong with it. So that's just my editorial comment on the Cars films. But in the later sequels, you see this. It looks like they live in a universe where human beings once occupied, especially in Cars 3. In Cars 3, they're in a demolition derby, and there's a school bus. Now, it's not a school bus that would be large enough to have little tiny kid cars drive up inside of it, but it's something that is looks like a school bus designed for human beings. And yet there are no human beings in the Cars universe. So where did they all go? And then once again, why do the cars have teeth and tongues on the front? You might say, oh, well, that's for their gas. Gas is their food. But they get gas in their fuel tanks in this, you know, a side fuel door, just like regular cars. So why do they need to eat food? It only leads to one conclusion, that in the Cars universe, human beings built cars, they're self-driving, artificially intelligent, then underwent some kind of technological mutation, ate human beings or got rid of them, and ended up taking over the world. A great comedy sketch series on YouTube that also addresses these questions is Honest Trailers. Go to Honest Trailers. You will get lost in there for hours on end. So I will play them a little bit here and there because they do a good job of asking these questions in a succinct way that really gets you thinking about these movies. So here's some more of their thoughts about the Cars movies and the questions that inevitably arise when you watch them.
Like, do cop cars have to be cops? Or can a race car be a janitor if he wants to? And how are cars born? This car is a mom.
My mama is right here.
Mama!
What's the difference between boy and girl cars? There's a car pope, so is there Catholicism? What kind of car was Jesus? Sarge is a veteran, which means there were car wars. Was he in Car Nam? What kind of car was Hitler? Is the engine the brain or the heart? What's the difference between a doctor and a mechanic? If they open their door, do all their guts fall out? Why do cars even have door handles in a world with no humans driving them? Except this car has eyes and her headlights, and a steering wheel and seats. Oh, jeez, they did kill us all. They just evolved and covered it all up. Damn you, dirty brakes. Damn you all to hell. Oh, wow. I got really sidetracked there. Where was I again?
So be sure to go and check out. I'll leave the link to this in the description at trendhornpodcast.com. But that's the Honest Trailer for Cars and Cars 2. The next film up, I don't have as much to talk about. There's one thing that's just bothered me about it, and that's Monsters Incorporated. So Monsters Incorporated is about a world where monsters live in their own parallel dimension, and they can come into our world through closet doors and kids' closets. And the purpose is they come into our world to scare kids to harvest their fear as a renewable power source in the monster world. Though ironically, monsters are even more scared of us than we are of them. They think children are highly toxic. They don't want to touch them. Now, at the end of the film, they realize children's laughter is 10 times as powerful as a renewable energy source as children's fears. Now, what happens in the film is Sully, who I think is played by John Goodman, ends up in a little kid's bedroom, this little girl's bedroom, Boo. I think she's only like 2 or 3 years old. And she follows him back into the monster world. And great voice talent, by the way. John Goodman is Sully, Billy Crystal as Mike Wazowski. So I love these Pixar films because they get really good voice talent for them. And so Boo, this little girl, follows him into the monster world, goes on all these hair-raising adventures with him, and finally makes it back to her room in the human world. But if you follow the length of time involved, she's clearly been gone for over 24 hours. And so she ends up back in her room. And now I would think that by the time they got there 24 hours later, wouldn't there be police caution tape up? Didn't her parents freak out that she had been gone for that entire time? Wouldn't there be an investigation that she had been abducted or something like that? Now people might say, oh, maybe time passes differently in the monster world. So it might have felt like 24 hours there, but she was only gone for a few minutes in the human world. No, but the problem is in Monsters Incorporated and in the prequel, Monsters University, the monsters will have the stories will continue with them in the human world in real time and compared to the monster world. So there's no difference in how time passes in the human world or the monster world when it comes to the movies and the way they do it. So that was just something that always bothered me about Monsters Incorporated. So the other film I like is The Incredibles. It's a story of superheroes who have to live underground in their secret identities because the world has come to hate superheroes and outlaw them, saying that they cause more harm than good. And so it's about this family of superheroes that have to live underground because of it. You have Bob Parr, who's like the super strong guy, Helen Parr, who's Elastigirl, she can stretch herself, Violet, who is like the Invisible Woman, she can make force fields, become invisible, Dash, their like little 10-year-old son, son who can run super fast, and Jack-Jack, who's a baby who has all kinds of different powers. And so I love the adventure. I love the fact, by the way, that if you were going to make a Fantastic Four movie, this is how it should be done. Like, all the Fantastic Four films that have been done so far are terrible, but the moral of the Fantastic Four is about a family getting together to use their superpowers to be able to do good. That's the essence of the Fantastic Four, and it's on prime display with The Incredibles. So I like that. I love the sleek design. I love the superhero action. But what's interesting about the film that most people don't think about is that it's kind of Ayn Rand propaganda. So Ayn Rand was a philosopher who promoted libertarianism, objectivism, about the worth of the individual, and that it's the role of government to stay out of the way of the individual, and that government always ends up encroaching on the individuals, especially the really gifted ones. There's an article in the Houston Press called Five Ways the Incredibles is Ayn Randian Propaganda. So let me read some of that to you, and keep in mind that a lot of this parallels Ayn Rand's fiction, like Atlas Shrugged. So if you haven't read Atlas Shrugged, and if you haven't read it, I totally understand, because it's like 1,400 pages, most of which are people giving radio speeches about trains. It's not the most riveting work, but a lot of it is paralleled in The Incredibles. So here's this article from the Houston Press. When The Incredibles opens up, we see a society that is openly policed by superpowered Ubermensch, or, you know, superheroes. These highly gifted individuals perform wonders for society and receive as their due admiration, obedience, and as implied by the special features on the DVD release, some sort of monetary compensation and support from the government. All that comes crashing down when Mr. Incredible saves a man from suicide and is subsequently and successfully sued in a frivolous lawsuit that sparks a series of legal challenges that unfairly brings the age of the hero to a close. That's exactly how the world of Atlas Shrugged begins its descent as well. Midas Mulligan is sued by people he denied an investment loan to, and a federal judge dedicated to the flawed fairness ideals that are the obsession of the novel's protagonist rules against him. Just as the superheroes in Pixar's world go into hiding, so is Mulligan the first to leave Rand's world to its own devices over the act. Next, the story goes on to talk about Galt syndrome. So in Ayn Rand's story, you have John Galt and the phrase going Galt, which is the idea of these intellectuals that society can't respect and won't stay out of their way. So the phrase going Galt is the idea that the intellectuals should just abandon society that doesn't really respect them and wants to encroach on all of their work with stupid regulations and things like that. And so this Randian idea of going Galt, or the intellectuals abandoning us as just deserts or punishment for getting in their way, shows up in the world of The Incredibles as well. But what about Syndrome? So Syndrome is the villain who creates his own technology to rival the superheroes after he was rebuffed as a child. His name was Buddy. And Mr. Incredible said, you know, I don't do teamwork. I don't have sidekicks. Go home, Buddy. And he realizes you can't trust your heroes. You can't trust anyone. So he becomes twisted and becomes the supervillain Syndrome and develops all of this technology. The article says, but what about Syndrome? Surely he represents the perfect Randian ideal. He's a self-made millionaire who built his fortune on his gifted technological abilities and can surpass the superpowered. He's basically Tony Stark. Except not really. Syndrome's goals have nothing to do with excelling. He wishes to sell off his science to the world's governments in the hope to create an entire race of techno-powered citizens that are the equal of the supers. He's basically the Dr. Robert Stadler of the Pixar universe, a character from Rand's novel. Using his brilliant scientific mind to undermine the elite and, by his own admission, create a world where no one is special. And so if you remember in the film when he's got the family all captured, he says, I'm going to create this technology and I'm going to sell it to everyone. And when everybody's super, nobody will be super. And so that's a running theme in The Incredibles, actually, that if everybody's super or everybody's special, no one's special. And that was Rand's point, that society wants to create this false egalitarianism where everybody's special, everybody gets a participation trophy. We don't want to have some people excel because that would create a dreaded sort of inequality. So Rand was obsessed with the idea that society wants to punish those who use their natural gifts and talents to excel and wants to pull those people down to some kind of dead level, so that we don't want some people to be special. We want everybody to be special. But the thing is, if everybody's special, nobody's special. And that's the twisted thing that Rand's protagonists try to fight against in Atlas Shrugged. And it's perfectly exemplified in this scene in The Incredibles between Dash and his mom. Dash gets called out of school because his teacher suspects that Dash is using his super speed to put a thumbtack on his seat when he isn't looking, and he thinks he's finally caught him on camera, but Dash is so fast, even the camera can't catch him. It just shows a tiny little flicker. And so his mom is like, Dash, you know, why are you doing this? Why are you acting out this way? Because Dash isn't allowed to use his speed in productive ways. So if he's not allowed to, he's supposed to hide. Remember, all the superheroes went into hiding to avoid the lawsuits. So he's not allowed to use his speed in open or as a hero. So he ends up using it in secret for destructive purposes. And remember the thing I talked about, Rand and specialness, comes up very well in this conversation.
Dash, this is the third time this year you've been sent to the office. We need to find a better outlet, a more constructive outlet.
Maybe I could, if you'd let me go out for sports.
Honey, you know why we can't do that.
But I promise I'll slow up. I'll only be the best by a tiny bit.
Dashiell Robert Parr, you are an incredibly competitive boy, and a bit of a show-off. The last thing you need is temptation.
You always say, do your best, but you don't really mean it. Why can't I do the best that I can do?
Right now, honey, the world just wants us to fit in. And to fit in, we just gotta be like everybody else.
But Dad always said our powers are nothing to be ashamed of. Our powers made us special.
Everyone's special, Dash.
Which is another way of saying no one is.
That is Ayn Rand right there, where the mom is exasperated and repeats what society has drilled into everyone's heads. Like, stop worrying about being special. Everybody's special. Just be happy with that. And Dash says, that's just another way of saying nobody's special. So next time, watch The Incredibles and pick up a copy of Atlas Shrugged if you feel like going nighty-night, because as I said, it's kind of a long work that drones on a bit, but an interesting one nonetheless. All right, the last film I want to talk about is the Toy Story series, 1, 2, 3, and regrettably 4. I was not a big fan of it. I'll explain why. First, hats off to Pixar. Toy Story is what put them on the map. The original Toy Story is a masterpiece when it comes to computer animation. I mean, this was done back when, like, Windows 95 and Windows 98 were the programs that they were using. And yet they were able to create a film that still has watchable value today that looks great. And they were smart in how they did it. Because back then, obviously, you couldn't get super amazing, high-def looking people for computer animation. So what kind of a story do you tell? They were able to tell a story about toys. Even if you tried to make animals, they wouldn't look quite right. The animation that they had in the mid-90s and the late 90s made everything have kind of a plastic look to it. So they thought, well, why not tell a story about toys? Because toys look plasticky. And so it works perfectly. So if you watch Toy Story, you'll see that the human characters barely show up in Toy Story. It's almost entirely focused on the toys that are involved, except for one character, Sid, who is the antagonist. Sid is the boy who lives next door to Andy, who tortures his toys and breaks them apart. Though you got to give Sid credit. He doesn't know that toys are alive. So what, you know, if he's breaking toys apart, well, it's better than setting cats on fire or something like that. It's a totally normal playtime for him. But he's definitely a child that looks creepy and weird, because in mid-90s animation, even if you go forward several years to something like the Polar Express, trying to computer animate human beings, you easily wander into the uncanny valley. It's that area where a robot or a drawing of a human being almost looks human. It's almost human, but it's just off enough that it gives you the willies when you look at it. You can tell that it's not quite there, and it just gives you the heebie-jeebies. So Sid definitely falls in the uncanny valley that they try to make him look human, but he's all distorted because it's mid-90s animation. But that's okay, because he's the antagonist. I give it a lot of credit for animation ahead of its time, and I give it credit that Toy Story 2 is one of the few examples where a sequel improves on the original and makes it better. So Toy Story 2 is to Toy Story as, you know, Empire Strikes Back is to New Hope. Godfather Part 2 is to Godfather. And finally, in Toy Story 3, it rounds out the trilogy perfectly. And man, I was crying like a baby at the end of Toy Story 3. Because the toys finally make it home. Andy is all grown up. He's about to go off to college. and he takes his toys and he donates them to another child. And this was smart, actually. Toy Story 3 came out like 10 years later, so the film jumped ahead 10 years in time for those of us who, you know, went on with our lives as well. Those of us who watched Toy Story as kids have grown up to become adults, and so Andy is now an adult, and he's gifting his toys to another little child, Bonnie, that will start the cycle all over again. And he waves goodbye to his toys, and then we see Bonnie playing with the Toy Story toys and her toys, and they start to get settled, and the camera pans up and you see the clouds in the sky, and the clouds are the same as the clouds on the first shot of Toy Story 1 when we were in Andy's bedroom as a child. And it forms a perfect loop, and it should have just ended there. And then Toy Story 4 came along for merchandising to sell Forky, and I absolutely did not like it. It didn't feel like a Toy Story movie to me. It just had the wrong pacing to it, wrong character motivations. I could do an entire episode probably on why I did not like that movie, but I'm just going to say I didn't really like it. Though what I will say in watching all four of the movies, that I still have lots of unanswered questions about the Toy Story universe. So, for example, why does Buzz act like a toy? Do the other toys do this? So Buzz Lightyear in the original Toy Story, the conflict comes that he thinks he's a toy. He thinks that he's a real space ranger. Why doesn't he act like a toy? He comes there, he thinks he's a real space ranger who has crash landed on another planet, and he's got to try to go and protect the galaxy from the evil Emperor Zurg. Why does he think that he was once a space ranger and then comes to later realize he's a toy? Does every other toy do that? Did Woody go through a phase where he thought that he was a cowboy and then realized that, no, he was actually a toy? I don't think he did, because in Toy Story 2, he totally forgets about his cowboy backstory that they talked about in the TV shows and everything else. So why does Buzz have this existential crisis, but Woody and the other toys don't? Also, does Buzz really understand that he's a toy at the beginning or not? He seems convinced he's a space ranger, but then he says and does things that are more indicative that he thinks he's a toy. So, for example, when Woody tells him that he's not able to fly, that his wings are plastic, Buzz says, "I could fly around this room with my eyes closed." Wait a minute, fly around this room? I thought you had crash landed on an alien planet, not in somebody's room. Also, why does Buzz act like a toy around Andy? If he thinks he's a space ranger, why does he instinctively freeze and just pretend that he's a toy when Andy is around? So that never made sense to me. If he really thought he was a space ranger, why doesn't he just act like it and talk to Andy as if he thought Andy was just another large life form on this planet? Also, what's the deal with the different toys? Like, which toys can talk and which ones can't? So, like, what is a toy? Like, is a bouncy ball a toy? Are stacking rings toys? I mean, my kids play with those, but they don't talk in the Toy Story universe. I guess the rule seems to be, like, you need to have a face to be able to talk. But the little eyeglasses, there's, like, a toy binocular set that Woody looks through to spy in Sid's yard. It's able to talk, and it doesn't have a mouth. It just has eyes. Which brings me to something else that's terrifying. Woody looks through the binocular toy and sees that Sid is about to blow up a combat Carl. He's going to blow up a toy. It's got a firework strapped to his back. And so I have to wonder, do the toys, they purposely act as they're frozen? They keep up the act that they're a toy when people are around, because Woody, they are capable of showing emotions and talking to human beings, because Woody talks to Sid, the boy across the street, at the end of the film. He sinisterly says to him, "So play nice." And then Sid, of course, freaks out. But then Combat Carl, did he just stand there frozen, keeping up valiantly to the last moments of his toy life, knowing he's about to explode, instead of coming to life and saying, "No, please don't blow me apart"? So I just wonder, is that what's going through their minds? I mean, yeah, can a toy die? We see with Sid's toys, they become these weird Frankenstein creations that have their heads swapped on other bodies. Do they still survive? Even if they're taken apart, they just can't talk anymore? Like, are toys born? What do they think of when they first come to life? And then especially, let's say they don't even die. What is the worst fate that could happen to a toy in the Toy Story universe? To me, it'd be being buried alive in a landfill. I mean, Stinky Pete even references this in Toy Story 2. He says, "You're all fools. You're going to end up trapped in a landfill for all eternity." And I think, yeah, what happens to toys then that are thrown out and then end up in a landfill crushed by garbage. They would have to be like stuck there for all eternity. They'd be in this landfill until they eventually are decomposed by methane gases. Now, I know what you're saying is, Trent, you're thinking a little bit much into this, aren't you? Well, when you have seen Toy Story 85 times like I have, watching it with my children at home when I am tired, or on road trips in the car when I bring the portable DVD player, you start thinking these questions in your mind. And if you had these questions too, I would also love to commiserate with you on TrenthornPodcast.com. If you have other questions that I didn't bring up, I would love hearing them as well. Or if you have ideas for future Free For All Friday episodes, like if there's something you really want me to talk about that's just totally random, odds are I might have an interest in that random subject too. So I'll probably do a poll asking for insight about future episodes, not just on our theology episodes Tuesdays and Thursdays, but Free For All Fridays as well. If you want to leave your insights for that, your suggestions, go to TrenthornPodcast.com. But thank you guys so much. I really appreciate the support. Pray for me as I keep working on a debate prep and other wonderful things we have coming up. You guys are awesome, and I hope you have a very blessed day.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrenthornPodcast.com.